The heart as mother of the world, the gate of sorrow. Overcome any bitterness because you were not up to the magnitude of the pain entrusted to you. Like the mother of the world, you are carrying the pain of the world in your heart. So say the Sufis. We enter the gates of awakening carried by the same melodies, the same songs of joy and despair that first called us to the Spirit. The ocean of life brings us waves of birth and death, joy and sorrow. For many, as at the beginning of our search, it is the painful truths of life that become our sacred gateway, that open us to the great heart of compassion. The blow of tragedy, the devastation of our losses, may have begun our return to the Spirit, and now, in a deeper octave, this dimension of awakening opens our being to the shared pain of the world. To enter through this state is called awakening by the gate of sorrow. It is said that on the morning of the Buddha's enlightenment, he looked out upon the vast universe with newly awakened eyes of wisdom, and tears began to roll down his cheeks. He saw beings in every circumstance of life striving to be happy. Yet, out of misunderstanding, these beings were acting in the very ways that brought suffering to themselves and caused suffering to others. Some say that when his tears touched the earth, they took life and became Tara, the goddess of compassion. If you stand by the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, you will see the same tears and cries for compassion, not just for the lost temple of Israel, but for the sorrows of all people who live in separation from the divine. Morning and evening, the heart calls out in prayer, "Answer us, God, for we are in great distress. Please be near to our outcry. Let your kindness comfort us. Before we call to you, answer us, as even the prophet Isaiah has said, 'And it will be that before they call, I will answer, and while they yet speak, I will hear.'" Without understanding the source of suffering, human beings strive to gain happiness by possessiveness and greed, through violence and hatred. We act out of delusion and ignorance, creating pain as an inevitable result. Our grasping, our aggressive entanglement in the world, brings with it unavoidable struggle and loss. Yet all is done purportedly to seek safety, to find happiness. The Buddha saw what every wise heart comes to know, that life on earth is painful as well as beautiful. Yet our confused reactions magnify this fundamental pain into an even greater suffering. As I read these words, human decisions create war in 28 countries. Millions hunger, although there is abundant food available. Millions languish in sick rooms or hospitals ill with diseases that we have medicine to cure, vaccines to prevent. This suffering is not separate from us. Buddhist teacher Sylvia Boorstein writes about attending her synagogue on the day the mourner's prayer is said for those who have lost relatives in the Holocaust. Many people stood reciting the prayer. I looked at how many people were standing and thought, "Can all these people be direct survivors?" And then I realized that we all are, and I stood up too. There are times in spiritual life when it feels as if all the barriers we have erected to shield ourselves from the pains of the world have crumbled. Our hearts become tender and raw, and we feel a natural kinship with all that lives. The cries of street children echo in our minds. Images of terrorism and racism, ecological destruction, poverty, and slavery fill our consciousness. It is as if our consciousness has broken open to the struggles of humanity and the earth itself. We may feel that we are in a charnel ground. We may see the suffering of countless generations, and in this we recognize that there is no escape. Yet only by opening our eyes and heart to the suffering of the world can we find freedom or peace. In our own way, each of us, as a Buddha to be, must look into this great question. What is the truth about suffering in human life? What is the cause of this suffering? In the fire sermon, the Buddha addressed the genesis of the sorrows of the world. Everything is burning. The eye is burning, and visible sights are burning. The ears and the sounds they hear are burning, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind. With what fires are they burning? With the fires of greed, of hate, of ignorance, burning with anxiety, jealousy, loss, decay, and grief. Considering this suffering, a follower of the way becomes weary of the fires, weary of greed and hate that fuel the grasping at sights, sounds, smells, tastes, body, or mind. Being weary, one divests oneself of this grasping, and by the absence of this grasping, one becomes free. To see the truth of suffering completely is to come to freedom through the gate of suffering. We can never successfully grasp or control the changing situations of life. We cannot possess our lover, our spouse, our homes, our work. We cannot even possess our children. Yes, we can love them and care for them, but if we try to control them, we only create suffering. Pleasure and pain, praise and blame, success and failure alternate day after day. The world itself has pain and pleasure woven into it as night is woven together with day. If we resist this truth, we will inevitably suffer. There's a story told of Ramakrishna, a Hindu sage whose visions and devotion became legendary throughout India in the last century. For days he sat by the side of the Ganges, lost in prayer, seeking a revelation of the face of the Divine Mother, the creator of life itself. And then, in an amazing moment, the surface of the water rippled, and out of the river rose a huge and beautiful goddess, shining hair dripping with the waters of the river, eyes like pools that contain all creation. She opened her legs, and beings emerged from her body, children and animals, a fountain of births of all kinds. And then, in a terrible moment, she reached down and carried a newborn child to her mouth and began to eat it, blood running down her mouth and across her breasts. For she who creates is also she who destroys. She is the source, the continuation, and the ending of all life. And then the goddess slowly sank back beneath the waves, leaving Ramakrishna to contemplate her power. When we open the heart through the gate of sorrow, we sense how pain and dissatisfaction are woven into the fabric of experience. Even in the midst of pleasure, we strive to maintain it, anxious about when it will end. And in the midst of possession, we worry about loss. Even the most beautiful birth and the most gracious death come with pain, for entering and leaving the body is inherently a painful process. We know that throughout our day, experience changes from pleasant to neutral to unpleasant and back again ceaselessly. This unending change is itself a source of pain, and our habitual reactions to it can create in us a continuous sense of struggle. One strategy for gaining liberation is to focus our attention directly upon this inherent, continuous experience of dissatisfaction and pain. We must sense it clearly and find in its midst a freedom that releases us from any identification or grasping. Maha Neb of Thailand teaches her students how to understand dissatisfaction by paying precise attention to what motivates each action and movement throughout the day. She instructs them to be absolutely still and not change posture or perform any act unless they see what experience in the body and mind necessitates the change. When they awaken in the morning, they are instructed to lie still, meditating quietly for a time, and not to move. But after a time, they notice that lying in one posture for so long causes the body to become stiff or painful. So they move in order to be more comfortable. Again, after some time, They may notice the discomfort of a full bladder, so they get up and go to the bathroom to relieve this source of pain. But the toilet seat is hard and the bathroom is cold, so to alleviate this discomfort, they go out and sit comfortably in a chair. Then their belly offers up morning hunger. To alleviate the hunger pain, they go to eat. But then they must clean up, because leftover food will rot and smell bad. Then they go sit quietly again for a time, until the next pain or discomfort causes them to move, and on it goes. By the careful observation of the source of each action, a constant movement to alleviate suffering is revealed. Yet those who face this truth do not find it a formula for despair, but a gateway to compassion. For within the heart is found a freedom and love even greater than the suffering. By facing the pain of the world honestly and openly, they awaken a fearless and merciful heart, the universal birthright of humanity. When we honor the gate of suffering, what arises is the wondrous power of compassion. This compassion is described as the fluttering of the heart in the face of the pain of any other being. It is a tenderness for all forms of life, all that is born and dies, all creatures who live by one another's births and deaths. Sometimes it is compassion for ourselves. The need for such compassion is there in every journey, Buddhist or Hindu, Jewish or Christian. The question of human suffering is central to the journey of grace and redemption. One nun recounts, "The month before Easter had been our usual preparation with extra vigils and prayers. It was spring, and I decided to let go and surrender myself to them as I never had before. I spent hours contemplating the mystery of Christ on the cross. And then Easter was over, and we had gone through the joy of resurrection, and the whole community felt so open by it all. One evening, about a week later, I was in my room looking at the modern crucifix, which is all we had on our walls. Then I was overcome by sadness and pain. My body began to ache, and I lay on my bed in agony. I felt as if I was dying. It felt so real. I was taken over and began to weep for Jesus on the cross, for his suffering and death. And then I was Mary, holding her crucified child, and I knew that the crucifixion wasn't over. I was all the mothers who had lost children in warfare, through famine, through disease. I was the desperate mother in Biafra who couldn't feed her starving children, the mother swept by the typhoon in Bangladesh, struggling, unable to save her child. I was all the young men, the soldiers in the senseless wars. I was the cows and pigs on the way to the slaughterhouse. I was the modern generals and the Roman soldiers, the welfare mothers and the slumlord, all who would die, all who are in pain. I lay there, watched over by the pain of the world, so much pain, I couldn't bear it. My heart simply wept. And then Jesus was there in my body, and we were holding it together, the sufferings of the world, and I could see that to hold it in mercy was divine. It broke open my heart. It changed my life. And when I met the pain, it was not my pain, but the holy pain that opens the heart. This is God's purpose for our sorrows, to connect all our hearts. There's so much mercy, mercy within mercy. Sometimes this mercy is learned in the loneliness of our own cell. Other times, we cannot do it ourselves. We need another human being there to witness our sorrows, to touch what is closed in us. One of the gifts a wise teacher offers is the capacity to hold up the mirror of compassion so that our hearts remember how to open. One Zen master recalls his early years of Zen. "I was trying so hard, had faced so much grief and pain in my practice, and then I had hit my limit. I was about to give up. I went in to see the master, who saw the extent of my struggle, and she changed in an instant from a strict, demanding Roshi. It's as if she became the goddess of mercy. "Very good, very good," she said. I felt like she had reached in and touched the most tender place in my heart with her compassion and her voice. Dipama Barua, a saintly Buddhist elder and grandmother, worked in this way with students in Calcutta and in her visits here. Students would come to her with meditation questions, which she would answer patiently. Then she would offer tea and food. She would ask concerned questions about their health or family. When one student explained how upset his parents were that he was studying meditation in India, she reached under her mattress and pulled out part of her savings and said, "Go buy your mother a gift from India." And when students would come with their greatest struggles, with hearts breaking to the sorrows of the world, she would encourage their practice. "You must see this too," she would say, and then bless them and embrace them, stroking them all over, all the while repeating soft words of loving kindness, until they softened as if held in the grace of a great mother. This is the way to freedom through the gate of sorrow. In it, we discover enough mercy and compassion to allow the full truth of life and our own incarnation, its dance of agony and beauty, to be seen and accepted without resistance. If we allow what Zen Master John Tarrant calls an opening to the tears of the way, wisdom will be born. In his book, The Light Inside the Dark, he quotes one senior practitioner who seemed defeated by an unexpected grief and wept day after day until her weeping began to change. "I became flooded by memories of my father and the pain I'd suffered from his absences and from being handed around to foster homes, neglected and disregarded. I had thought that I was opening up, and then suddenly this thick personal material seized me. I was totally caught. I wept and wept, and everything I saw seemed a fresh occasion for tears. As I watched for several days, my mood began to change, and the tears became more impersonal, causeless, the tears of being moved by life. I was seized by a tenderness, especially for unseen, neglected, and abandoned things, a particular shade of blue in the sky at dawn, the bones of mice dropped by owls. These later tears are the tears of initiation. We are taken up into largeness." To let go in the deepest recesses of the heart, to release all struggle and wanting, leads us to that knowing which is timeless. As one teacher has said, "After I opened beyond any sense of myself, I could feel my pain change to the pain of the world. I saw how much the universe moves and the planet is on fire, that much pain. And yet it all could be held, and it didn't touch anything. It rested in the midst of an enormous peace." In the gate of sorrow, we free ourselves from illusion and grasping, from a false separation from all of life, and we hold it all. We can rest in the great heart of Buddha, of Jesus, in the heart of the one who knows. Chapter 5. Nothing and Everything, The Gate of Emptiness. You live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality, but you do not know this. When you understand this, you will see that you are nothing, and being nothing, you are everything. That is all. The Venerable Kalu Rinpoche. From where does our life of joy and sorrow arise? When the source of creation is personified, it is given names like Allah, Brahma, or God. The divine source can also be experienced outside of personification. Mystics and meditators who describe this source experience the cosmos as coming out of a sacred emptiness, a great void. Jewish mystics describe it like this: out of emptiness, God has made the world. It exists in the heart of God alone. To know our place, we must again become as nothing, and then what is holy will move through us and illuminate all we do. What does it mean to become as nothing? Understanding emptiness or selflessness is disconcerting. It is hard to describe in the way water would be obvious, yet hard to describe for a fish. Still, when we experience its truth, it opens us to peace and joy in remarkable ways. Angelus Silesius, a Renaissance Christian mystic, explained, "God, whose love and joy are everywhere, can't come to visit unless you aren't there." When Nachiketa was handed a mirror by the Lord of Death, he was directed to an investigation into the source of his being. In the depths of this inquiry, meditators can discover the experience of emptiness. This emptiness has two sides, the emptiness of self and the emptiness of the void. The emptiness of self shows itself first in our lack of control over our supposedly fixed self. Anyone who turns inward to meditation or prayer immediately encounters the ever-changing thought stream of mind and the endless ripples of moods and emotions that color each moment. These thought streams and emotions have a life of their own. In them, a whole vision of our childhood or the replay of complex adult experiences appear, compel our attention, and disappear in moments. We usually take ourselves to be the sum of these thoughts, ideas, emotions, and body sensations, but there's nothing solid to them. How can we claim to be our thoughts, or opinions, or emotions, or body, when they never stay the same? Perhaps we can take a step back and look at who it is that knows this, the space of knowing in which they arise. In meditation, we can shift our attention from the sense of everything being unconsciously tied together as my experience to a more silent, less possessive observation. This silent observation allows us to see the first aspects of emptiness, called selflessness or egolessness. The discovery that the usual sense of oneself as a separate, solid being is only an image created in our mind. This is what Alan Watts called our best-kept secret in The Book on the Taboo Against Knowing Who You Are. When one Westerner, now a Tibetan monk for 20 years, first met his teacher Lama Yeshe in the 1960s, he was a successful filmmaker and TV producer. After they were introduced, Lama Yeshe found out this would-be student made films. "Oh, you make TV? Movies? I good actor. I best actor," Lama Yeshe laughed. "I can be anything, you see, because I am empty. I am nothing." Then he laughed again. Emily Dickinson also pointed to our intuitive sense of this truth. "I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody, too?" What are these mysterious descriptions of non-self about? For one meditator, the experience of emptiness of self was a signal experience in her spiritual life. She had studied with lamas and masters throughout India. When she returned from many years in Asia, she still regularly spent days meditating. "I was up in the mountains and awoke early when the morning was still dark. I sat so very quietly day after day, and then the most wonderful and terrible experience came. I disappeared. All that I am was washed away. I didn't know its name at first, and you can't give it names, even nirvana, because it's before names. And such bliss! I knew it was no longer my own heart and body, it was the world." In the emptiness of self, the world becomes transparent, clear, uncomplicated. We realize that our sense of separate self is untrue. Who we are in a conventional self disappears into silence, peace, and the pure experience of being without anyone present to possess that experience. And, as emptiness of self is recognized, we come to understand the second dimension of emptiness, the emptiness of all phenomena. One Buddhist text, the Samyutta Nikaya, explains it this way. Suppose a person who was not blind beheld the many bubbles on the Ganges as they floated along, and after careful examination saw how each appeared empty, unreal, insubstantial. In exactly the same way, can we carefully examine sense impressions, perceptions, feelings, and thought, all that we experience, and discover them to be equally empty, void, and without a self. Emptiness of self opens us to the experience of void, the dynamic emptiness out of which all things are born. In the Buddhist tradition, awakening to emptiness is the gateway to nirvana, the freedom of the heart referred to as the unborn, the uncreated, the unconditioned. The realization of this gate has been heralded by mystics throughout time. It can be entered in many ways. Three of the most common are through meditation, through an encounter with another who is awake, and through immersion in a solitude so deep we become transparent. Knowing through meditation. Here is one teacher's experience during an extended insight meditation retreat. By now, after several months, I only needed 3 or 4 hours of sleep. The whole instruction was to stay absolutely present and alert and not react to anything that happened. So many thoughts and emotions had come and passed. There were days of intense loneliness, of tears and grief, and then times of rapture. Some days I felt like I was dying, my body was falling apart. I was surrounded by a world of death and destruction. Then, after, it all evened out. I felt like I was floating through hours of meditation, with waves of light and ecstasy. My body dissolved open like the sky, with no boundaries. As I became quieter still, the experiences kept coming. They came faster and faster. Now it was as if I could notice every single thought, even though there was a constant stream of them. Every thought form would create a world of idea or memory or imagination, and then vanish as soon as it was noticed. In the deepening silence of mind, I began to feel the subtle pre-thoughts, as if the mind were pregnant, about to release its next thought. Sounds, smells, emotions, every tiny perception was noticed and released, or rather floated free, seen like fireflies in the night. I kept up a diligence of sitting and walking, feeling often as if I were under the sea in a still and transparent world. One afternoon I lay down to meditate in the heat of the day. My eyes closed, and effortlessly there was an awareness of all the sensations of this new posture. All the perceptions floated by, arising and vanishing like bubbles in soda. I felt myself letting go into this, and the perceptions came even more quickly, as if the universe was rapidly pulsing, now becoming pulses of light like fireflies. A moment of fear came and went, and then my mind opened, then somehow fell down and all was totally silent, beyond silent. There was no me, no experience, nothing, no words to put on this, only a knowing. The world rested in an ocean of peace out of which all appearances arise and vanish. It was stunning. I knew the essence of consciousness to be this vast peace. There was certainty that I, and everything, were just an appearance in mind. And beyond this world, where everything is born, changes, and dies, is this ever-present reality. Of course, everything came back, but more luminous, transparent, shining with joy. The first moments of opening into non-self can also be simpler than this. Another teacher tells of his first understanding of emptiness. It was during a walking meditation in the garden near the temple. I can remember the exact spot. I lifted my foot and put it down on the earth, felt all the sensations of moving, and knew there was no one to whom it happened, no self at all. The thought came, "It's an empty process," and this thought was seen to be as empty as the step. It is said that the spirit of meditation should continue as we rise from the cushion. One meditation teacher had been sitting a long retreat in India, but his realization began out in the courtyard with a sick puppy on a cloth on my lap. People drop off unwanted dogs for the temple to care for, and at this retreat there was a new litter of puppies, several very sick. I sat for days with one whimpering puppy after another. I was completely cut open by this. Many dogs would come and go. That day, though, I saw that the underlying truth of life doesn't change, although it manifests in those changing bodies. I kept meditating with the puppies and the puppy shit, and then went back into the meditation hall. I became very still. Thoughts and intentions would arise and dissolve in an instant, but there would be no impulse to follow them. And then some deeper letting go happened, like a huge bursting of all perception into space, emptiness. Suddenly, there was no self, nothing to do or solve. That was all just foolishness. I was lifted off my cushion with a smile 6 feet wide, and in the emptiness joy arose, a river with no edges, a dance of emptiness, a confirmation of freedom, where life is no problem, self is no problem, even sick dogs are no problem. Emptiness in another's sacred presence. The understanding of emptiness is contagious. It appears we can catch it from another. We know that when a sad or angry person enters a room, we too often enter into sadness or anger. It shouldn't surprise us, then, that the presence of a teacher who is empty, open, awake, can have a powerful effect on another person, especially if that person is ripe. In every tradition, there are stories describing awakenings of students through direct encounters with their master. One teacher of meditation and Raja Yoga experienced a decisive opening at a lecture in California, which led to a 10-year journey of practice in India. I was listening to Krishnamurti on a spring day at his school grounds in Ojai Valley. He sat on a single wooden chair, a slight old man with a commanding presence. There were 1,000 of us resting on the grass, sheltered beneath a grove of ancient live oaks. All our focus was devoted to the speaker, who challenged everything we knew about life, about ourselves. He spoke of true attention. "Are you really listening?" he asked. "Not with the limited ideas of a thought or reflection, but in the utter silence beyond the mind." And in that instant, my mind stopped. I entered an enormous stillness. The grove seemed to expand and float as if it were in the center of the galaxy. The words came out of the trees. I felt I was totally alive, yet dead, beyond myself. All was filled with light, and a timeless, boundless space was all that existed, ever. As the words drifted through like a dream, I knew that I had let go with Krishnamurti, as if the joy of awakening were contagious, and I had caught it, felt it, entered it. In Zen, the phrase turning word is used to describe those few words, like Krishnamurti's, the silence beyond the mind, that can turn the mind to its true nature in an instant. Such moments of awakening are recorded in the hundreds of classic Zen stories known as koans. An example is Zen Master Hui Neng's reply when asked about a flag fluttering in the wind. Was it the flag that moved or the wind? Hui Neng answered, neither. It is the mind that moves. In the presence of a skilled teacher, such a question can lead a person to turn from the particulars of a moment to a timeless perception. We remember our original nature, the boundless heart, which contains all things, yet is not limited by them. A Western Buddhist teacher remembers a time in the mountains of India. I had passionately devoted myself to meditation for several years. One evening, the teacher called us together for chanting, prayer, and a lecture. I was seated in the front row, completely attentive. In the middle of the talk, I heard the teacher say, "Your face is like a mask." That was like lightning in a clear blue sky. It cracked my world. In a moment, everything I thought I knew dropped away. I'd done 100 acid trips before coming to Asia, but they all paled compared to this. This was a whole new dimension, outside all the senses. It completely transcended my senses and identity, all that I thought I was. It was beyond pleasure and pain, ecstasy and joy. I wept for the beauty of it for a long time. And that was 26 years ago. In all these years since, it's that unborn reality that matters beyond everything. It is a torch that illuminates everything. That's all there is, and somehow it's present in this moment too. A variety of conditions come together in these joint awakenings. There's the openness of the student, an earnest willingness to discover. There's also often a significant preparatory period of practice or purification. The account above followed many years of strict retreats of both Vajrayana and Vipassana. Then there is the respect and awe surrounding a master, and there is the field of consciousness of the master, the direct presence of love, freedom, and emptiness that he or she is able to convey. Knowing in solitude. The knowledge of emptiness is also born in the solitude of the heart. In the Gospel of Mark, we are told, rising early the next morning, Jesus went off to a lonely place in the desert. There, he was absorbed in prayer. Don Jose Rios, a revered Huichol Indian shaman, visited the U.S. at the age of 106. He said, "In my 80 years of training, I have suffered much. Many times have I gone to the mountains alone. But you must do this, for it is not I who can teach you the ways of the gods. Such things are learned only by yourself, only in solitude." In entering solitude, one does not necessarily find silence. At first, solitude can be noisy, filled with the conflicts of the body and the mind's ongoing commentary, the Chogyam Trungpa called subconscious gossip. Meditation practices help us to find a way to genuine stillness. In them, we find that there are many levels to silence. The first is simply external silence, an absence of noise. Then, there's the silence of the body, a growing physical stillness. Gradually, there comes a quieting of the mind. Then we discover the silence that comes as a witness to all things, and then 20 deeper levels of silent absorption in prayer and meditation. Still further, we come to the indescribable silence beyond the mind, the silence that gives birth to all things. To enter silence is a journey, a letting go into progressively more profound levels of stillness until we disappear into the vastness. Bernadette Roberts, a respected Christian mystic, had been a nun for 10 years and later the mother of 4 children. In her book, The Experience of No Self, she tells of her journey to silence, of initial bouts of fear, but finally losing herself in silence until subtle thoughts would time and again pull her back from its embrace. But one day, sitting alone in a chapel, she began to discover where silence would lead. Her experiences came as part of a long process, pulling her into emptiness and letting go until her life itself united into a whole. Here are her words. Again there was a pervasive silence, but this time no movement came. I left the chapel as a feather floats in the wind. Outside I had a difficult time because I was continually falling back into this great silence. But as the days went by, and I was once more able to function as usual, I noticed there was something missing, and I couldn't put my finger on it. I could not find an explanation in the writings of St. John of the Cross or anywhere else in the library. I was coming home that day, walking with a panorama of valleys and hills before me, that I turned my gaze inward, and what I saw stopped me in my tracks. Instead of the usual, unlocalized center of myself, there was nothing there. It was empty. And at the moment of seeing this, there was a flood of quiet joy, and I knew, finally knew, what was missing. It was my self. Physically, I felt as if a great burden had been lifted from me. I felt so light. I looked down at my feet to be sure they were on the ground. Later, I thought of St. Paul's experience. Now, not I, but Christ lives in me. And realized that despite my emptiness, no one else had moved in to take my place. So I decided that Christ was the joy, the emptiness itself. He was all that was left of this human experience. For days I walked with this joy. There was no mine anymore, only his. For another teacher, the opening to emptiness came as a surprise at the very beginning of his path. He spent 30 years in Buddhist training after that in order to understand and integrate where he had begun. It was early in my spiritual life. I'd gone to a few meditation classes, and now I was lying quietly, in solitude, resting after so much time thinking and wondering. My mind was in the clearest, most open state. It also felt charged, alive, yet absolutely still as well. I had not known such a balance of alertness and ease was possible. I picked up an old Buddhist text and read a few lines. Although the one mind is, it has no existence. In its true state, mind is naked, immaculate, being of the voidness, transparent, timeless, uncompounded, not realizable as separate things, but as the unity of all things, yet not composed of them. Arising of themselves and being naturally free, like clouds in the sky, all that appears fades away. The whole of the world and nirvana, as an inseparable unity, are one's own mind. Everything I knew of the world shattered open. I couldn't say what was left, for there was nothing of myself at all. There was that which is here before the sense of self ever existed. I knew once and for all that there is no self, that any sense of self and separation is an illusion. We are empty like a dream, a play of mind. Gradually, some of the world came back, though in many ways my sense of it had changed completely. I had no idea how I was supposed to live anymore. For weeks I walked around in a kind of lightness and shock. So this gate of emptiness can reveal itself, whether in solitude or in the sacred presence of another, in deep meditation or in the mountains. Attentive to this mystery, the heart can open to directly experience the emptiness which gives birth to all things. Taoists speak of this as sacred hearing, not by means of the intellect's understanding, but the hearing of the spirit, in which all the senses are open and empty. Only then, with the emptiness of all the faculties, can the whole being listen and know what is right there before us, which can never be heard by the ear or the mind alone. This is the wisdom of those who know not, and who yet, being empty, carry a heart full of light. Isaac Newton knew this when he wrote, "To myself, I am only a child playing on the beach, while vast oceans of truth lie undiscovered before me." Through the gate of emptiness, for that child, the vast unknown is not a source of terror, but the field of his joy.
This concludes tape 2 of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, with Jack Kornfield. Our program continues with tape 3.